How long is the tape?
Half hour.
Okay.
Does that suit you? Or sure. We might even be done sooner. But okay. We won't go over half an hour. Well, it's taken us quite a while to get here. I'm with Kenneth Atchley at Terry Riley's. And it took us quite a while, but we understand why you like the idea of being far away from the city. It seems quite beautiful and peaceful.
It was ironical this morning. I was going from San Francisco to Berkeley to pick up Barbara, and they'd closed the university off-ramp off the interstate, and so it took me like 45 minutes to get 5 miles, and I kept thinking, yeah, Terry Riley's living up in the mountains, and here I am messing around on the freeways. It was like saying there's a lot of irony.
So it's really hot.
Yeah, came with a good time.
What do you dream about?
Oh, it varies from time to time, but sometimes I dream that I'm having trouble performing music.
Mm-hmm. That's a performer's dream.
Yeah, performer's dream. I had one of those last night, that's why I came up. But usually they're pretty good, musical dreams.
What's happening?
Well, sometimes great ideas, you know, some being able to play music that you've never imagined, or some music that's really taking you out of yourself.
And do they inspire you? Can you use them?
Yeah, occasionally it won't be me playing, it's somebody else, and I'll wake up and I'll think, well, that was a great idea, and do I have the right to write it down because somebody else was doing it? But, yeah, they do. But I can't think of too many instances where I got a musical idea directly out of a dream.
When do you get your best ideas? So when you wake up or in the shower or...?
It varies. It's just the best ideas are, of course, the ones where you really feel wired. And you might be doing anything at that time. But there's some kind of a energy that's coming into you that's not your normal energy. What I would call my normal energy. It's a kind where I can't wait to try to get it down, and I'm usually frustrated to try to find out some mode to transmit that idea to some kind of form. Be tape, or if it's tape, then you can't get the tape recorder going fast enough. If you're writing it, the pencil's always breaking, the computer's broken down, or whatever. But it's hard when you're really wired to get the ideas. Oh, sometimes you're lucky enough to be at a concert and it happens to you while you're playing. That's the best.
Does that happen recently?
Happens from time to time. Guruji always says music is always a very little, the great music is always a very little part of your total. You know, those real moments are a small part of your total output. They just happen occasionally. And I begin to think he's right. That you can never really satisfy yourself that often, otherwise, I mean, there wouldn't be much point to your life if you were in that state all the time.
I think that's across the board with your life, that there are a few moments in everything that are very perfect, and the others are almost like a striving for it. Or
do you think recordings, like modern recording technology, or even saying the record industry, gives us a perverse slant on that? I mean, a new album comes out by somebody and it sounds like they've done 45 million just hearing the product, it sounds like they've done 45 minutes of brilliant music, like they've just sat down and done it, even though we know that there's much more time put into it than that. I wonder if it gives people a perverse slant on their own output, so to speak, whether it be music or whether their job or just their...
Well, I don't know. I think I'm not sure that I've heard any music that you're describing. I mean,
just like pop music. It just sounds like it's all well-oiled and it's there, and the person puts out an album a year. And in other words, it's those rare moments of years and years of work, but it's all condensed. And
well, I think the slick albums that you hear are 50 takes, which are patched together, aren't they?
They usually sound a little bit like that after you get to know them, but they... I'm talking about, I guess, those kind of musical moments which everybody recognizes as being kind of liberated, that is not bound by any kind of personality or even ideas. They kind of transcend all of the concepts we think about making music.
What's the earliest music you ever heard that you remember?
A tune called South of the Border Down Mexico
South
Way.
South of the Border Down Mexico.
And I remember crying when I heard it on the radio. That's why I remember it, because it moved me so much I started crying. And I thought I'd really like to do music like this.
Oh, I love it. That's Kevin Austin's recollection too. A composer, teacher, friend of mine from Montreal when he was in nursery school. How old were you when that
happened? Well, I couldn't have been much more than about a year and a half. Or 2 years, maybe.
Because I was living. Where were we living?
I was living in Colfax, which is not far from here, is where I was born. And I do remember, I was singing a lot when I was. My mother said I used to sing. I was kind of a precocious singer, you know, singing like at a year old or something, a little over a year old. I was singing tunes off the radio. But that tune stuck in my mind because I remember the experience of listening to it. And how beautiful it was, you know, it really moved me. It was like, I don't know what I'd think of it today. But
that's a nice tune. It's not a bad tune.
No, I like the tune, but I don't remember the performance, who did it or what, you know.
That's funny. I mean, it's not funny, but it's fascinating. He was listening to Swan Lake. He was at nursery school in England, and he was 4 or so, and he wept, too. Uh-huh. He really wanted to write something like that. You made us some tea before. What were you doing with the mortar and pestle?
Pester and mortar. I was grinding up cardamom seeds.
Is that what kind of tea we had?
We had tea. We had Darjeeling tea made with cardamom seeds and fennel seeds and milk,
which
is called chai in India.
Do you drink it a lot?
Every day.
What do you eat most of the time?
Well, that really varies a lot. But I when we're here, you know, when I'm living here at the ranch, I can kind of stabilize my diet. When I'm on tour, it really gets outrageous.
Do you eat junk on tour?
Yes. I've been known to.
Yeah? Like what?
Hamburgers and... Not really sweet junk, candy bars or things, but I'll eat food that I ordinarily wouldn't eat.
Fries and burgers.
Mm-hmm. I kind of have a perverse enjoyment of doing that. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know you can come back here and just clean out.
But we, like you see, we have a big garden, so we eat a lot of stuff out of the garden, the orchard. And
do you normally avoid meat?
I was just going to ask.
No, from time to time I feel like I have to eat meat. I feel... a need for it. I have different periods of my life I've been vegetarian, and usually here we don't eat meat. But once in a while, you know, it feels like that's the thing to do. When I noticed the Tibetan Lama's doing it, and they're such liberated beings, I thought, well, if they can do it.
That's a comfort, isn't it? If you see someone pretty much idolized doing something.
When I met Pandit Pranath, I was a vegetarian, because I've been around some other yogis and trying to live very sattvic, clean, you know, existence. And I went to India, and the first night he brought home a lamb korma from an Indian restaurant and to his home, and he said, "Eat this." And I said, "Oh, I'm a vegetarian. I can't eat this." And he said, "A lion doesn't live on grass."
Oh, so you ate it?
So I ate it, and
was it good?
It was great.
So how did you meet him?
I met him first in California. He was he came over here in 1970, and Lamont Young brought him out here, and we arranged a concert for him at Mills College, and he stayed at my house. That was about May of 70.
So had you studied Indian singing before that, or
I didn't even know what singing was. To me, singers weren't even musicians, because I'd been hearing opera and stuff like that, and I thought they always sang out of tune, and that they just were kind of egotists that made all these loud bawling noises. And when I met him, the first thing I liked the singing. I thought it was really great, and it was not like anything I'd ever experienced as singing, but I still wasn't convinced that I could do it. I thought maybe So I asked him if he could take me to India and show me a good tabla player. And he said, yes, I could. Yes, he could. But then he took me and told me to study singing at the same time in India. And so that's how I, little by little, I just stopped playing tabla and got into the vocal music.
So were you you were a composer then? Mm-hmm. Like in the sixth, when did you start being a composer? Always?
I started writing when I, when my piano playing career, as I was trying to do a, become a classical pianist in college. And after a few ill-fated recitals, I decided to become a composer because it was the only avenue for a pianist who couldn't play perfectly to do. I mean, I couldn't see anything else to do, so I thought, well, I'll, if I compose music, at least people won't be able to really tell if I'm hitting the wrong notes. And so I started doing, you know, writing music, but actually got very interested in it and met other good composers like Lamont Young and Pauline Oliveris, and
she's a good
who were the same age as me, and you know, there was kind of a good little community.
That was in San Francisco?
Mm-hmm.
And so when was that around?
Like around the late 50s.
Uh-huh. And so did you really sort of, did you get very famous after In C was written? Was that kind of like a turning point?
Not exactly when it was written, but a few years later, I went to New York a year after I wrote In C. And I was noticed by some of the people at Columbia Records because David Behrman was a producer. And he came down to my loft in New York, and we had a mutual friend, Richard Maxfield, who was a very good electronic music composer of those days. And so David introduced me to John McClure, who was the directing Columbia Masterworks, and John came to a couple concerts and asked me to do some albums for them. And I think after the CBS albums came out is when it started to happen as far as, you know, visibility.
So was In C like a turning point as far as style also? Like, was that the first sort of minimal, I hate to use all those terms, but you just have to label something for right. reference point. But was that like the first?
Well, it was the first piece of its kind that I know of. You know, it was the, it started this idea of little repeating modules becoming, making a whole piece.
I love it.
And I was just trying to do something that, wasn't trying to start a style or anything. I was trying to do something that I'd been doing with tape loops in live performance. And because I had worked with Chet Baker and I'd record him and these little snippets of his trumpet playing, which I still think are some of the most beautiful things I've heard. And I combined them electronically into loops and then, you know, multi-track them. And so I thought it'd be really great if they could, something like that could be done in live performance.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I didn't have 12 Chet Bakers or 13, and he's a real master musician, but even with that, even with a small group of amateurs, we got a pretty good effect for the first performance.
When was the first performance?
I shouldn't say amateurs, because actually Pauline was in it, Steve Reich was in the first performance, and Morton Subotnick.
Was David Rosenboom the first? He's on
the
album, isn't he?
Yeah.
And John Cale?
John Cale wasn't ever in it, no.
I thought he was on the album.
No. David didn't play the album.
Oh.
I made an album with John Cale, a rock album called The Church of Anthrax.
Kenneth was telling me about that in the car.
The only rock and roll album I've ever done.
Or probably wished.
So,
it was a lot of fun. I don't regret it.
And then was Rainbow and Curved Air one of the next big ones?
Rainbow and Curved Air was probably the biggest. In terms of like people buying it and you know, worldwide recognition, even in NC, because it was a different. It was a. I think of Rainbow and Curved Air now as being kind of the first of the New Age pieces.
You know?
Although it's not, I think it's much better than any New Age music. I mean, not with saying that with ego, but I mean it's much more involved musically. It's not just these same old modal tunes that you get.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah, we know.
But it was the first of that, you know, that kind of thing of flight music, you know, soaring, flying.
God, did I love it. I was a housewife.
I used to love it. I used to listen to it all the time.
Oh, man, did I love it. I was taking undergrad music courses in 75, And we actually used in C for sight singing or for some kind of vocal training, believe it or not.
In Montreal?
Yeah. Good. And then Rainbow and Curved Air. I mean, I just say the same thing. I just listen to it over and over again, plotting how to get away from my existence.
I got a lot of letters from people after that came out saying the same thing. They'd always say the same thing. We put it on the record player, just let it play over. I think it was that kind of thing. It made a good environment.
So when I came to Mills College in 79, and you were my teacher and advisor, you said one thing to the class. And you said, when you're composing music, you first of all have to please yourself. And then, you know, and if you do it any other way, you're foolish. You must please yourself first. Obviously, I'm sure that you still believe that, do you?
Yeah, well, I don't know how, if you can't please yourself, how you could even work, because...
you can't keep going.
Yeah, you can't keep going. I mean, it's not that you can totally satisfy your desires to make perfect music, but... if you write for other reasons, if you do music for other reasons, you're going to end up not being happy with yourself, I think, after a while. I mean, sooner or later, you'll run into a place where you can't identify with what you're doing. There's no continuous thread. But when you really are feeling things deeply, then even if people don't like them, it doesn't disturb your work because you're being moved. You're getting a feedback on your own work, which I think is... necessary for continuous work, for working year after mm-hmm. year.
Do you still get up at 4 a.m. to sing and practice?
I'm not quite as diligent as I was when I first started. I still get up early. I get up like these days at 5:30.
Oh, well, that's pretty early.
There were periods when I lived up here where I would get up at 3, you know, for long periods of time, day after day, just to... because it's just a magic time. Either you stay up until 3 or you get up at 3, but that middle of the night period for me is very special. There's a musical feeling there that can't be had almost at any other time. So I like to do that. I mean, I like to even do it now, but sometimes I have responsibilities during the day that... That I'm using an excuse now. I mean, anybody can get up at 3. All they have to do is, you know, bite their lip and get up, jump out of bed. But I make an excuse now that I can't do it.
But you still get up early?
Yeah.
And what if you just had a typical day where you don't have too many responsibilities, what would you do? Just your favorite kind of way to pass the time?
Well, I think my favorite, very favorite activity is singing raga. I mean, to me, that is the most beautiful, perfect essence of musical expression. It's yourself, you're the instrument, just you and the tambura and the form, the tradition, everything is very perfectly developed. So when I'm doing that, I'm the happiest. But it does take, even if I didn't have to do anything else, there's a certain energy that's required for doing that I probably couldn't do it 16 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like giving a speech for 16 hours a day. You're using your voice, and you have to give it a rest once in a while, unless you're real young and strong. But I'd say that would be my first choice. What I usually do, end up doing practically, is I'll sing, you know, for 3-4 hours in the morning, and then I'll...
Quite a lot.
And then I'll write, you know, I'll switch over to... working on some compositions, or if I'm doing maybe a little a piano concert's coming up, I'll sit and practice piano to try to get, you know.
I like it when you play piano, when you give piano concerts. I mean, I love singing too. I like singing more than anything.
I like the piano too. The piano. See, the great thing about all these different instruments is they all have their own
personality
and their own way of making music. I mean, mm-hmm. the voice can't do, like Grigie's always saying, needle can't do shovel's work. I think that's
yeah,
true.
You that's know, great.
A piano, a voice can't do what a piano can do, or vice versa. Mm-hmm.
Because of all the voices. You said you're traveling a lot and that you're not home all that much. How many days a year are you traveling? Are you traveling a third of the year or less?
Well, first of all, you know, living out here, traveling for me means going to Berkeley too. So,
oh, okay.
So I'm not doing worldwide traveling. A lot of my traveling is just going to the Bay Area. What I'm saying is I'm not home a lot of the time because a lot of my work is in the Bay Area and especially involved with Pandit Pranath and the Indian music practice. But I'm away from here about half of the year.
Where? I mean, where have you gone this year, let's say, or the last 2-3 years?
I've been
in
Japan, I've been in Europe a couple of times.
That's giving concerts everywhere.
Yeah, I've been all over the States quite a bit. You know, I've been down in Oklahoma, Kansas, St. Louis, New York, you know.
Where do you like to go? Like, I mean, if you had your druthers to get a gig somewhere now, where would you pick? What would come first to mind? Like an ideal place to perform? Where would you like to go?
I think I'm too moody to pick one place.
Come to mind?
I've got plans to go to China next year. That's interesting because I've never been there, and I've always been interested in Chinese people and their cultures, and their, especially the older Chinese cultures. And
you get to perform there?
Well, I've got a plan to do the 30th anniversary of NC is coming up hold on a second, let me get back on the right track of years here. 64 to 89 is what?
The 25th,
yeah. Oh, the 25th anniversary, that's what it is, of NC is coming up. And we wanted to, I had this idea that I talked to my record company about recording it with a Chinese, traditional Chinese orchestra, traditional Chinese instruments.
That is hot.
So he has agreed to send me over there. And what we're going to, well, the plan right now is to do a double album. One will be a piece I'll write next year for the Chinese orchestra, and the other one will be NC, 25th anniversary.
That's a good plan. Will Anne go?
I hope so, yeah. I'm also going with this, I wish I had his name right here. This is not good for the radio. Is this being edited? Can this be edited?
Nah.
Just move along.
What's the gist of it, though?
The gist of it is I'm going with a very fine Chinese musician who, I think his name is David Liang. He plays qin, you know, this mm-hmm. Chinese stringed instrument. Mm-hmm. And he also is a composer. He's worked with Paul Horn and several other people, and very fine. So he's going to be the bridge to the Chinese people for this kind of strange music. He'll be able to explain it to them, and also since he's a musician in musical terms.
That's wonderful. I'm jealous.
I didn't think it would really happen either. Maybe it won't. It's still a year away.
So do you think anything's going to save humankind?
I think they're being saved all the time. I mean, I think as far as in terms of our predicament here with the way we're leading our lives.
Yeah. Like our you know, sort of foreign policy and our environment, both, you know.
Well, it doesn't look good. I mean, when you look out and see what people are doing, and even what we're all, who are supposed to be fairly enlightened beings, what we have to do to live in this world, it doesn't feel good. We have to do a lot of polluting and stuff just to keep up with our own lives. Like to drive up here, you had to use a car.
Absolutely.
It doesn't look good, but I'm always hopeful. I do have an optimistic side, and I think that part of what's happening can't be avoided. I see it as part of fate that this conservative element that's in our government, that's in power now, probably had to happen for some reason in order to clear, you know, and if we can avoid them taking us into total destruction, I think people will get enough of a negative feedback from these kind of people to change things. But there's been a lot of damage that's been done already to the planet and to people on the planet. Yeah.
What were you saying about the fourth state? I don't know the term that it was. We were talking inside.
Oh, the Kali Yuga.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people think we're in the Kali Yuga now, which is the fourth Yuga, the fourth age. And there's four ages that continue to recycle, and the Yugas are very long. And I don't want to say how long, but I think there's something like 25,000 years, or maybe they're 250,000 years, but they're a long time.
They're long, yeah.
Longer than we can experience in one lifetime. And that's the age that's traditionally associated with destruction, that clears away all the, you know, the debris and to make way for a new age, for an age that's more enlightened than the age of truth. So we might be we might be at that point. And it's painful for us because we have to think that all the things we're attached to on this earth are, you know, are going to pass away. But on the other hand, this has probably happened many times. And these cycles are probably necessary. I mean, for us to be born in these bodies, we've probably inhabited other bodies before. We're attached to these because we're in them right now. It means we have to, we identify with them. But if we didn't identify with them, it would be easy to give them up. So the high teachers through the ages have said, don't identify too much with your current surroundings, your body. Just live in it as an observer. So I think if we go through this period, even though it's painful for us, probably something very beautiful will be for the next age, for whatever is going to be born into it.
Yeah, I sort of subscribe to that theory. What about Harish? When did you meet him? And
Harish, I met in 1969. Harish Johari.
And who was he, or who is he?
He's an artist. He's a painter and a very, very fine, I think, philosophical type thinker and a very evolved human being, very high kind of consciousness. He's been a teacher for many people. He's traveled around the world giving seminars on art, and in general what he's trying to do is to get people to break through their own attachments to, you know, what their current life is. And he does it through art, he does it through staying awake, and he does it through laughing. He laughs for hours on end, and he gets everybody laughing until they're, and they can't stand it.
Laughing's the greatest, it's the greatest medicine.
Yeah, it is fantastic. So he was the kind of introduction for me for Pranath, because he had met him in India and had been a big admirer of Pranath's music for years, and he told me he's the best music teacher in the world when I first met him. And the greatest singer in the world, living today in India, so if you can study with him. So I was alerted to Pranath a year or two before I had actually met him through Harish.
And you said you used to, your link with Harish was that he stayed up all the time and you played music, so you played music?
Yeah, I'd go up there and play music, and he would sing. He also sings and plays together, and he would never sleep, so people would, sometimes he would take people on sleep fasts and they'd stay up a week. I never made one of those where they might, I don't think I was up to doing that.
How long did you stay awake?
Oh, I would just sometimes go up and spend the night, and then I'd go to sleep the next day, and he'd be up with the next group of people, and he'd be like that a week after week, just never sleeping, just taking one group of people after the other, a day shift and a night shift.
And you were saying at that time you played a Chinese violin?
Oh, I was...
Two strings?
I was playing in the Floating Lotus Opera Company, which used to be in Berkeley.
Oh, I've heard of it.
And it was Daniel Moore. He's a really great poet, friend of Allen Ginsberg's, and, Solo Hamowitz and a whole bunch of people kind of... Berkeley, were living in Berkeley at that time. We did these big mystical operas with the Tibetan themes and Hindu mythology themes, everything all mixed up together. Yeah, it was a beautiful group. So I used to, you know, we had these swarmandals, these zithers, you know, and Chinese violins and drums. And I'd sort of, at that point, I'd done my records for CBS, and I found I didn't like the world in New York of the music business. So I came back to California to kind of drop into something that was less glossy of a lifestyle. And so the Floating Lotus felt really good. It was a very soulful organization. It was only music and spiritual things.
So when was this around?
And that was like right after I did the Rainbow and Curved. I guess it was 69. And Harish was in town at that same time, so all these things were fitting together. It was like dropping into more into yoga and...
More peaceful.
Yeah, looking for something that was more meaningful than just record companies and contracts.
What are you writing right now? I mean, are you writing more notes and things?
From time to time, because people have asked me to do it, because I didn't do it for many years, and also because I wanted to kind of check out to see what would happen if I did do it. So I've written a lot of pieces, especially since I left Mills College.
You wrote for Kronos?
Written hours for the Kronos, I mean hours of string quartets, literally, I think four hours or more of string quartet music.
And did you have fun doing it, and do you like it? You like them?
I like doing it a lot. It isn't all burning desire on my part to write music, although I like doing it. But if I weren't a performer, if I couldn't perform myself, I wouldn't. I don't think I could just do that as an only activity. I have to play and sing. And
yeah, I understand that. What about that stuff for the Rovo? What was that called?
Music for the Toyn.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Trying to describe it to Kenneth. It was pretty elemental. I liked it, and it kind of was raw or something, but not raw in an unformed way.
Well, four saxophones.
It was fresh.
Four saxophones.
It felt fresh to me. You know,
pretty raw.
So did you like that performance? Did you listen to it?
Yeah, I
are we using it?
Yeah, you could use part of it if you want.
Okay.
I think they did a really good job of getting. It's a very difficult piece to put together. I mean, it takes time. I think they're going to be working on it over the years. Yeah,
that's good. It's like reading War and Peace. You have something to sink your teeth into.
I find myself when I try to do a piece for myself to perform it. Sometimes it'll be 4 or 5 years before that piece actually makes sense to me in a real, you know, I'll know there's something there that I maybe will perform it, even in concerts many times, then suddenly one performance that will come together or one day practicing will come together, and then I know that it's, then usually I don't play it anymore.
Done with it.
Yeah, you can't, because then you're always trying to reach that place that you reached in, and it's time to drop it then.
Do you have some advice for composers?
No.
That may be good advice. That's what the one you just said, though.
There isn't any advice. I mean, they have to be motivated themselves or they won't be doing the music. And once that happens, they don't need my advice. Once a person is really on their own track, and that's what has to happen eventually, they don't need anybody. They just have to, if they like somebody, like I've liked people, then you try to hang out with them, try to associate with them, try to glean a little bit, get a little rubbed off on them.